After a long, hard-fought, and expensive campaign, J.B. Pritzker has been elected to be our next governor. And he says despite our current political climate, he plans to bridge the partisan divide.
I really just don't believe in partisan rancor as an answer to anything. And we've got to listen to everybody. Good ideas can come from anywhere, from Republicans and Democrats.
Plus, speaking of that political climate, Illinois firmly declared itself a blue state on Election Day. But according to philosopher Anthony Appiah, firm political views are here to stay.
We are as tribal about our political identities as we are about anything. In fact, we're more tribal about our political identities these days than, for example, we are about our religious identities.
My conversations with those two men and more coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we'll hear from philosopher Anthony Appiah about how tribal our political beliefs have become. We'll also speak to two actors behind a new play at Steppenwolf called Downstate. But first, speaking of politics, Democrats won all of Illinois' statewide offices on Election Day, including the governor's office. On Tuesday night, Democrat J.B. Pritzker beat Republican incumbent Bruce Rauner by about 15 percentage points. Governor-elect Pritzker will take office in January. He's busy now appointing his transition team. Yesterday, I had a chance to speak with him about those plans for the transition in the next 4 years. Governor-elect Pritzker, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, Nyla. Great to talk to you.
So now the work begins. You spoke in your victory speech about everything from improving high school graduation rates to access to health care to immigrant rights and gun control. I'm not going to ask you what your main focus will be, but I wonder if you can give us three tangible things you hope you'll accomplish in your first year in office.
Well, we're going to focus on what's good for working families, and that means creating jobs and raising wages, lowering the cost of healthcare and expanding it, and making sure that we're providing a quality education for every child, in addition to affordable college for our families who right now can't afford that.
Republican Governor Jim Edgar is on your transition team. He said in the past how hard it was for him to make the transition to governor, how much he had to learn, even though he was a career politician. What advice has he offered you so far?
Well, I think, you know, by virtue of the fact that we put him on our transition, you can see that I'm trying to bring people with real expertise and experience to the table. You know, that's something that the governor has said from the beginning of our conversations, that it's very important that we have the right people at the table as we're putting together an administration. And I think bringing him on board also is an indication of the kind of bipartisanship that I intend to bring to Springfield. After all the rancor and the unwillingness to work together, I think it's time that we actually started talking across the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, because we've got some real challenges in the state, and we can only get things done for working families if we work together.
Have you had a chance to speak with Governor Rauner apart from him conceding to you last night?
I have not yet, but our staffs are beginning to speak with one another today about transition and working together over the next 10 weeks so that we have a smooth transition to a new government.
What questions will you have for him as you make your transition?
Well, of course, I want to hear about his experiences and what the biggest challenges that he found during his term in office. I think that'll be very important. I also want to hear about where he thinks going forward over the next 4 years, where he thinks the hills are that we need to climb. We may disagree on policy, but I think he probably wants the best for Illinois. I do too, certainly. And so I think we'll have a lot to talk about.
You mentioned getting things done in Springfield. Speaker of the House Michael Madigan is often considered the person who helps get that done in Illinois politics. And I know sometimes that can be a tricky relationship, but you have to work with him to get the legislation done. You may have different priorities, but you're both members of the same party, of course. Still, how do you plan to operate independently from him?
Well, let's start with the facts here, which are no matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican, that you've got to work with whoever the Speaker of the House is or the President of the Senate, because you don't get to choose who they are. It's just they've been chosen already. And so you've got to be able to work with them. And I'm not somebody who walks out of the room when you can't agree on something. I have worked together with people to get real things done, like expanding preschool and childcare, like building an incubator that's created thousands and thousands of jobs. And so I'm going to work with the president of the Senate, the speaker of the House, and the chairs of the various committees so that we can get real things done for working families.
I wanted to ask you about your victory speech on election night. It was very optimistic and it was striking, really. I think from the bitter and angry tone that we've often heard just over the past campaign year, not just in Illinois, but across the country. And we know that there are deep disagreements both in the U.S. and here in Illinois. How do you plan to work through those without losing that optimistic tone that you expressed yesterday evening?
Well, first of all, I'm not a bitter or angry person. That I work together with people and have during the course of my entire life. And that's why, as I've said during the campaign, I intend to work with people of both parties. Last night, I called the leader of the Republicans in the House of Representatives and the leader of the Republicans in the Senate and offered my hand in friendship and also to work together with them to get things done. That's the kind of administration that I'm going to run. I really just don't believe in partisan rancor as an answer to anything. And we've got to listen to everybody. Good ideas can come from anywhere, from Republicans and Democrats. And we just have to work together to solve these big challenges that our state is facing.
Governor-elect J.B. Pritzker, thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks so much, Nyla.
The holidays are coming up. Maybe you're hoping to snag a deal on the latest Apple or Android device. Maybe you're already planning all of that Black Friday shopping. Whether it's an iPhone or Android, each one is more advanced than the last, and it can be easy to forget that the first iPhone came out just 11 years ago. Today, we use these devices all the time. In 2016, Apple said users unlock their phones an average of 80 times a day. There's other research that shows we touch our phones as many as 2,000 times in one day. Given all of that, how do our phones affect our mental health? Alejandro Lleras is a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois. He's also a member of the Mechanisms of Cognitive Control Group at the Beckman Institute at the U of I. Lali Abril is an associate professor of communications at UIC, and I spoke with him in September. I started by asking Alejandro how much these smartphones take up our attention, even when we're not using them.
The actual number today is probably worse. I think every day and every year, we're interacting with our phones more and more. I think one thing to keep in mind is that we have very large companies like Google, but also smaller companies, maybe like the New York Times, who are constantly trying to improve their way that they connect and they call your attention. So we have lots of billions of dollars focused on capturing your attention. And they're getting better and better every day. And we have more and more pulls on our attention. So we unlocked our phone 80 times a day, maybe. And if you actually count, that comes out to like 5 times an hour during waking hours, not even considering the fact that you have to work and do other things.
That's a lot of time that we're spending on our phone. Yes. And then actually, it's not even just the time we're spending on our phone. You've looked at the fact that even if we're not actually on the phone, we're thinking about it.
Yes. And some of the research that we did in our lab looked at trying to understand the interactions with either the internet or your smartphone from an addiction angle, right? So if we take questions that we usually ask cigarette addicts or gambling addicts or alcohol addicts, you know, how much does doing this behavior interfere with your work? How much do you prefer doing this behavior to hanging out with friends? Then we can do that with focus on interacting with a phone. And we found that when you do that, there's a very large correlation between how people score in those kind of questionnaires and how they score in depression and anxiety questionnaires, which is kind of troubling.
So you're saying there's a correlation, it sounds like,
yes,
between what we see as traditional behaviors that can cause addictions to the way that we actually use our phones?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. So the idea is if you start using the phone or someone you know start using your phone to avoid certain problems in their life, or when they're sad, they turn to their phone, or when they're anxious, they turn to their phones. And to the extent that it starts interfering with their daily activities, then you start seeing something that looks like an addictive behavior. And I think more and more of us feel like we are maybe becoming addicted to our phones, right?
That's Alejandro Lleras, who's a psychologist at the University of Illinois, as well as with the Beckman Institute here at the U of I. Lali Abril is also with us from UIC. Lali, when we think about this, is what Alejandro is talking about, how hard is it for people to separate themselves from, as he's talking about, the negative impacts of technology when it's so ever-present, when it's always surrounding us?
Yeah, that's looking a little bit at the dark side of media and technology, which is very real, and it's worsening, it seems. However, my research, I focus on the bright side of technology. So I study how we can use media and technology to foster desirable political and health outcomes. For instance, in the political realm, increased civic and political participation and voter turnout. And in the health realm, for instance, how to exercise more and achieve healthier eating habits. So I'm not denying this dark side, absolutely not. However, what I focus on in my research is more on this more bright side of media and technology.
And so when you think about how we can use technology to better our health, as you mentioned, that's part of your research. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, I have looked, for instance, on how mobile technologies can help us track exercise much better than paper and pencil or relying on memory. So that's one side. Another side is to spread a social campaign and see how people discuss this campaign and make sense of the campaign. So these are some, you know, two examples of how we can use technology to foster better health outcomes.
And to that point, Alejandro, I think part of the reason why it can be a good thing as well as a bad thing is because it is so ubiquitous. And I wonder if you can explain to us a little bit about how you feel like engineers are designing these systems specifically to have our attention captured. Can you give us an example of how Facebook does this?
Yes. For example, let's say you post an article or a picture of yourself or something that you know and you expect is going to get a big reaction from the people who more closely follow you or your friends or family. You post it at a time that you expect people will be able to see it. Well, a lot of people have the intuition that if their friends are online at the moment, the post that they just put will appear immediately on their
friends' timelines.
On their friends' timelines, mm-hmm. right? And that if their friends respond, the second it responds, you're going to get a notification that says, oh, your friend Abby just responded to you. But in fact, this is not how Facebook works. So what Facebook does is they manipulate the time between delivery of the feedback they give to you, right? So even if you're looking at your timeline, you won't see those things coming one click at a time, one heart at a time, or one smiley face at a time. They'll deliver to you after some amount of time, look, 3 people responded to this, or look, 10 people responded to this. And what happens is that this is similar to the way slot machines work in a way. So when you go to play at a slot machine, you put your coins and you are always waiting for all the money to come out of the machine. But you
never
know.
You're waiting for them to all line up, right?
And you play and you play and play. And at some point, sometimes it happens soon. Sometimes it takes longer. That's called variable reinforcement schedule, which we've known for a long time in psychology. It is the strongest way to get people to learn and reinforce our behaviors. The strongest way is the best way to keep you just like at
this thing. Why is that? Because you don't know what's going to happen,
yeah.
So it has your attention?
Exactly. It keeps your attention. You keep testing. Oh, maybe this is the time it's going to work. And you keep looking, you keep looking. So going back to Facebook, you put the post and just like you wait like, okay, I'll wait 5 minutes. That'll be enough. Then you go and check. And even if other people have responded, Facebook is not going to show it to you. So you're going to be like, oh, but that's so weird. But it got you to interact with it. You looked at Facebook. You looked at other posts on in the meantime, and then you put it away. And then you're like, a couple of minutes later, you're like, oh, I wonder if this time, you know, it's like, again, getting a handle on that slot machine and trying to see if now you got all the coins. And all of a sudden, you check, and there's like three hearts, and you're like, oh, wow, that's exactly what I was expecting. I'm so happy. You know, you get that
And in the
jolt.
Meantime, you've checked Facebook, what, like five times?
Exactly. So that's what they're doing. They're manipulating the delivery of the feedback to you in these specific ways to get you most addicted, in a way, to their app.
But Alejandro, to that point, earlier this month, Facebook and Instagram have announced tools for users to set limits on their platforms, as well as a dashboard to monitor your daily use. How would you explain these new tools that social media companies are using? Why do you think they're implementing this at the same time?
Well, I think it's the same way that cigarette companies ended up advertising that smoking is not good. I mean, there started to be a backlash in society of people realizing that maybe it's not good the amount of time that we are spending on these devices, that our kids are spending on these devices. So this is, I think, a part of a public relations campaign to try to improve their brand, all the while knowing that in the back they have hundreds of engineers and millions of dollars research going into capturing your attention more and more.
That's Alejandro Lleras. Lali Abril is with us as well. Lali, to that point that Alejandro has been making, I wonder how you think we can mitigate some of the negative effects while still getting the positive ones that you research. Where do you think the balance is?
This is also a matter of content. So what kind of content people use in their phones and technology. So it is clearly not the same to spend the entire time on Facebook versus using it for interpersonal communication. So communicating with maybe for work, with your colleagues that are, you know, not in the same locality, or communicating it for family matters, or FaceTiming with friends that are far away. These are all very different activities that we can do or that we can play with technology that have different effects. And so, well, yes, one very clear outcome is always like, oh, you know, don't do it too much. But always this falls back to the individual. And the individuals can do, you know, so much.
That's Lali Abril. She's an associate professor of communication at the University of Illinois Chicago. You also heard from Alejandro Lleras, professor of psychology at U of I. You're listening to The 21st.
Support for The 21st comes from University of Illinois Press, hosting the Association of University Press's annual book, jacket, and journal show in the Link Gallery at the School of Art and Design, November 5th through the 16th. University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. What's the difference between an identity and a label? Whether it's how we express our faith, what country we claim as our home, how we look, or what gender we are, these are parts of our identities. But are they just labels? And who really is the other when it comes to our humanity? Those are the big questions Kwame Anthony Appiah grapples with in his latest book, The Lies That Bind, Rethinking Identity. And by breaking down color, class, creed, and our national identity, this is a book about how many of the ways in which we think about our identities are wrong or, at best, misleading. I spoke with Anthony during the Chicago Humanities Festival this past weekend in front of a live audience at the University of Chicago. And I began by commiserating with him about our shared sense of being the other. I wondered how people in New York City, where he lives, interact with him and what identity they give to him.
On a typical day in New York City, where I live, I bump into more people than many of my ancestors would have seen in a lifetime. And if you're going to interact with those people, you're going to have some idea, since people turn out to be different and are all the same, you're going to have some idea about what basis to do that. And I think one of the great roles of these social identities is to allow us to engage in interactions with strangers. And most of our interactions are with strangers. Our most important interactions aren't with strangers. But every day, we're constantly interacting with strangers. And also, we're coming into contact with new people. Again, every fall, I meet a huge new lot of students. And pretty quickly, of course, I figure out about them that the most interesting thing about them isn't that they're what they obviously are,
by looking at them. And pretty soon they figure that out about me. But to begin with, it helps them to have some orientation to my... Well, so, you know, I imagine the most important thing for most people who bump into me in New York City is, first of all, that I'm not white. That orients them a bit. They don't talk to me as if I were a white person, whatever that would be. Second thing is, once I open my mouth, I don't sound like a lot of New Yorkers. A lot of people can guess that since I sound roughly like the BBC, there must be some connection with England. And then, of course, that I'm a man. And that shapes interactions constantly and all the time, everywhere, gender, I think. So those are the things that people sort of notice, first of all, I think. How useful are they? I don't know, not much, but still better than nothing, probably, I suppose. And if one thinks about what it would be like to try and live a life in which one wasn't guided at all by anything like that, I think you can see that while it's reasonable to focus, as I often do, on the dangers and harm that identities can do, it's worth remembering that there's lots of everyday things, like these daily interactions, which they simplify for us.
Because they really are labels, and labels help us organize things.
Yeah.
But I do want to talk about the whole idea of how this can be harmful. And I think my favorite passage of the book was where you talk about Western civilization and the myth that you believe Western civilization is. And I wonder if you can remind us, there's a passage where you talk about how Western civilization sort of rises as this golden nugget.
Yes.
From ancient Greece to Europe, essentially, in this kind of line that seems unbroken.
Right. Golden because precious, and nugget because concentrated. The idea is that we've sort of got this thing that was dug out of the soil in Hellas, so somewhere in the Greek-speaking world, and that's been handed on. And the idea is that this thing is, as it were, what binds together all the people of something called the West. There are at least two really important things that this story misses. First, it doesn't matter, this thing, if it consists of Plato and Aristotle and then, you know, Sophocles and Euripides. If that's what it consists of, then those things were simply not important to most of the people most of the time in most of that period, most of that history. Nobody in the Bavaria in the 17th century, except very highly educated people, had ever heard of Shakespeare, let alone Plato, Aristotle, Herodotus, Thucydides, and the people that we mention in this context. So the first thing is it suggests that Europe and its descendants' cultures are held together by something that I just think couldn't possibly plausibly be said to be what's holding it together. But the second thing is that many of the most important monuments are the result of a shared history. The materials for interpreting, Aristotle say, were held by the Arabs. And it was they that provided us with the interpretive framework that we used, that was used in the Renaissance.
The Islamic world.
The Islamic world was significantly European for a long time. It was until 1492, from the late part of the first millennium. What we call Spain was mostly Muslim and was ruled by Muslims, very civilized, educated Muslims, much more civilized than their neighbors to the north. More generally, I think if what you're interested in is masterpieces, and I am interested in masterpieces, I love masterpieces, I am not putting down the people I'm mentioning. I'm not saying that they aren't worth study. But the way you get to own them isn't by being a European or a Westerner or white. It's by study and paying attention.
And I guess I'm wondering why you think that's so important. Because I imagine you would say that this whole notion of a Western identity in a way is somewhat dangerous.
Well, first of all, it's
inaccurate.
It's not true.
It's true.
But even if more of it were true, it's damaging, I think, because it suggests that there's some natural relation to these important things, as opposed to a relation that's generated by study and work and attention. And since the study and work and attention that matters about these things can be done by anybody who cares to do it, provided they learn the necessary languages and so on. It doesn't belong, in that sense, to any particular ethno-racial group or something like that. But more importantly, it's this claim to this West is now being used to mobilize hostility, various things, including the world of Islam, which, as I say, is particularly paradoxical and ironical because it was a significant part of this heritage was preserved for our interpretive purposes by Arab scholars who worked on these texts for a very long time. I suppose the most dangerous part of it is the use of this idea that these objects somehow demonstrate a sharp distance from the Muslim world, which I think is false, and B, that they are a mark of superiority to the Muslim world.
But I think a lot of what you're saying also comes to the what you talk about in terms of a country. And we decide what a country is, but then the question is, who's the we? Which I think is really a lot of what we're seeing, I think, in a very real way grappling with in America right now. And so I guess the question is when we think about who determines that, what do you think are the important things to look at when we're thinking about country?
So I think the answer to the question of sort of which things we should take to be ours as a nation is democracy. It's to have lively public conversations with one another in which we talk about what matters to us and try to get to some consensus about, in the domain of politics anyway, about what fundamental values we're going to allow to guide us as we deal with the difficult task of running a republic together. To do that, we need certain things. One of the things I think we need, which we have less of than we need, is respect for one another, despite our differences, despite the fact that we disagree about important things.
And so the problem is, of course, that in modern society, people are judged by what racial group they're in. They are judged by what religion they adhere to. When we're thinking specifically about America and race and class and religion, how do you think we can start maybe, is there a way that we as individuals can move beyond this?
Well, you mentioned a bunch of kinds of identity there. The first thing I think we can recognize is that we share identities with lots of people with whom we also are divided by identity, from whom we're also divided by identity. So all the ethnic groups have both men and women and gay and straight people in them. All the religious groups have people of many, many different kinds. And one thing that I think is worth thinking about when you find yourself all ginned up by some identity you have and thinking of the people who don't have it in a negative way is remembering that some of them are people with whom you share some identities, or all of them are people with whom you share some other
because
identities.
Because we have different labels and identities that we activate, right?
Yes.
So I guess that's always also the question when you're thinking about that, whether it's gender or race or religion. So I wonder how you think about how we negotiate all of those
so
things.
So I didn't write about this in this book, and if I'd known what was going to happen in our society, I probably would have written more about it. Of course, in the voting booth, we have these very powerful modern political identities. We have identities as conservatives and liberals, and we have identities as Democrats and Republicans and independents. And those are very, I mean, if you ask what's important in the voting booth, my guess is usually one of those. And my guess is that the reason why we've got sort of toxic identity politics around the other identities is because they've become aligned in various ways with these political identities. And we are as tribal about our political identities as we are about anything. In fact, we're more tribal about our political identities these days than, for example, we are about our religious identities. The big divide in the United States in religion isn't between Catholics, Jews, Buddhists, Muslims, and Mormons, and so on. It's between conservative religious people and progressive religious people. These kinds of political identities become salient often over modern history in democratic societies, which is that the mobilization of them is a really effective way to consolidate power. And political leaders have noticed this, and they do it all the time. This is not just a feature of the United States. It's a feature of much of the world today. And they notice also that connecting these political identities with ethno-racial identities can be a very powerful way of mobilizing people. So that's happened in many places in the world. It's happened in India in relation to religion. It's happened in Hungary in relation to, you know, real Hungarians versus the Roma, for example. In all of these cases, there are powerful political rewards for people who are willing to mobilize them in this negative way, which is why it's really and then it gets out of control. Then it gets out of control.
I wonder, though, how you think we can think about other people as fellow citizens, how we could do a better job of that.
Well, the first thing you can do in the, as it were, privacy of your own heart is to stop going along with the demonization of everybody else. And that you can do wherever you are on the political spectrum, because while I think it would be inaccurate to say that the dangers here are all equally spread across the spectrum, I think it's pretty fair and objective observation that there's a particularly toxic form of this kind of thing going on the right at the moment. Nevertheless, it produces a toxic set of responses, and I think it's very important to think about whether people with whom you disagree about politics nevertheless have legitimate grievances. However, we can't respond to one of the things they're responding to by giving them what they want. Because one of the things they're responding to is a sense that a certain kind of American who used to be able to think of him or herself as sort of the normative American, as the real American, a certain kind of solid, white, middle-class person, has been displaced in the understanding of most of us by the idea that Americans, real Americans, can be of all colors, all religions. They can be trans and cis. They can be gay and straight and bisexual and so on. And that's good. We like a country that's like that. Well, there are people who've enjoyed the privilege of being cis and male and white and sort of solidly middle class, and therefore the real Americans. Well, I don't think we can give that back to them, because it wasn't right that they had that. But we can give them things if they ask for legitimate things, and we can ask from them legitimate things for ourselves, because we are fellow citizens. And I think that this is just an example, as I say, of the way in which recognizing that there are identities we share, as well as the ones that divide us, is something that can be positive in politics. Now, I'm sure I sound Pollyanna-ish to many of you. I'm famously an optimist. I'm not famously an optimist. I'm famously an optimist among those among whom I'm famous, which is a very small number of people. But one of the reasons I am an optimist about these things is because I have seen how this thought that this person that I'm divided upon by someone is also someone with whom I'm united by something else, can actually, I've seen that happen over and over again. It happens over and over again when kids come out to their families. Sometimes they throw them out, so there are gay kids on the streets. But often, mostly they don't, and mostly they come to deal with it. And that's why, by the way, I think, you know, the lesbian and gay movement was right when it argued that coming out was a really important thing to do. It's because it means that lots and lots of people who thought they didn't know any gay people discovered that they did. And furthermore, they discovered that they needed them, that they were colleagues or members of their family or choir directors in their church and that kind of thing. And they made an adjustment. And now, even quite conservative people in this country find it hard to get excited into homophobic wrath.
Anthony, thank you for being with us. Thank you.
That was Anthony Appiah speaking with me during the Chicago Humanities Festival this weekend in front of an audience at the University of Chicago. Coming up after the break, I talk with actors from a new play at Steppenwolf Theater called Downstate. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When we talk about compassion in our society, who do we extend it to? How do we treat people who have committed what we often deem as the most horrific crimes, especially when they're against children? That's the heart of a new play called Downstate. It's on right now at Steppenwolf Theater, and it's written by the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and ensemble member Bruce Norris. It's also a co-commission and co-production between the Chicago Theater and the National Theater of Great Britain. In the spring of 2019, the play will transfer to London. Downstate has actually been extended at Steppenwolf. It's on from now until November 18th. And two of the actors, Glenn Davis and Amy Lou Wood, are with us now from the Steppenwolf Theater. Note to our audience, we are going to talk about the play, which includes some really difficult subject matter, including child sexual abuse, for the next 15 minutes. Glenn, Amy, thanks for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you for having us.
So that disclaimer that I just made, I wonder, have you guys had to make that to a lot of people when you explain the play, Glenn?
Yes, I do. My mother came recently, who's very religious and goes to church every Sunday, and I told her, make sure you go to the website, you check out what the play is about. The language is very colorful, and the subject matter can be incendiary, so I'll let her know right away. So I do that usually with people who I think might have some issue with the subject matter.
Amy, what about you?
I did the same with my mum, because she works back in England. She works for a charity which raises awareness for sexual abuse. It's the NSPCC. It's like a children's charity. And so I knew that she would be the toughest nut to crack with this play. So she was very... I didn't actually tell her till quite late on what it was about, which was bad. But just before she saw it, a couple of days before, I was like, mum, by the way... this it, and she was like, well, babe, I'm sure I love your performance, but I don't think I'll be feeling sorry for paedophiles. So it was quite difficult, but yeah.
And so I think, I'm sure the question that everyone asks you, but I have to say it was also the first question I thought of, was what made you want to do this play, Amy?
At first, I just wanted to do it because it was a Bruce Norris play. It was a leap of faith, though, I must admit, when I was first reading it, especially not hearing the voices. It's when it's in, just in your head, when you don't have other actors reading those parts and humanising them. There was one character in particular that I very much villainised in my head. I thought that he was kind of just beyond any human compassion when I read it in my head. But then when I was at the read-through, all that went away because I heard the actor read it, and yeah, it all just made sense to me, because it's harder when it's just on the page. When it becomes three-dimensional, it's a lot easier.
Glenn, what about you?
As someone who reads a lot of plays, I don't often find things that I'm particularly attracted to. I find things that I might like, or I might even love, but not something that I necessarily want to do. And this one sort of checked all those boxes. I like the characters. I love the play. I thought Bruce's writing was brilliant. Most times when you do a play, as an actor, selfishly, you go, okay, is the character something that I want to play? Is it fun? Is it particularly daring or insightful? And this play, I thought the character was all those things, but more so than that, I thought the play itself was supremely impactful emotionally, especially for me. I don't have a lot of experience with this subject matter, but I did have one incident in my own family that happened years ago. And I remember when it did happen, all of us sort of relegated that person to the sort of fringe of humanity and never really considered them again. And this play happened, and I had to consider that person. And I thought that if this play is making me do that, and I don't have a sort of dog in this fight, then people who've had an experience like this may feel some sort of huge emotional reconciliation that that comes along with something when you have an experience like this. I forget who made the quote, but I love this quote about any society is judged by how you treat the sort of lowest common denominator. And I think that when we ask ourselves how much are we willing to forgive and how far we're willing to go for that forgiveness, I think that it really tells you a lot about yourself.
So this play is set in an I think it's unspecified, right, where downstate this actually is. My definition of it, I found for people who are based in Chicago, means essentially anywhere that's not Chicago. That's probably an accurate description.
It's an unspecified city in downstate Illinois.
And these four men who have all been convicted of sex crimes against minors are all living together in this group home. And Glenn, I think that setting is a really important reflection of what you were talking about, right, in terms of how these men end up together.
I think it's very smart on Bruce's part. It's sort of too easy to set it in a big city like Chicago or New York or wherever. But I think that by putting it downstate, you really, in some unspecified city, you get this feeling that these men don't really have anywhere to go. They're sort of lonely in this nondescript place, and they're having to sort of figure out life, and you don't have the amenities that a place like Chicago would afford you. Not to say anything bad about cities sort of in downstate or anywhere else in Illinois. I just think that it makes it harder for these men to sort of get around and do things. One of the important parts of the play is about, you know, how these guys are able to sort of be mobile and get from place to place.
I'm speaking with Glenn Davis and Amy Lou Wood. Both of them are actors in the Steppenwolf play called Downstate, which is a co-production between Steppenwolf and the National Theater of Great Britain. Amy, I think your character is interesting because you're the only person who's not directly related to, like, you're the only person, you haven't committed, you haven't been the victim of a sex crime, you're not working as a parole officer. I'm curious about your character's role in this story because of all of those things.
I mean, there's so much mystery surrounding Effie, which is what I enjoyed, because why is she in this house with these sex offenders? Why is she spending her time doing that? And I think she brings in a youthful energy. She brings that into a house which is set in its own rhythm. You know, that they know how it works, that they're four cogs in the machine, and it's kind of a well-oiled machine. Even though it's dysfunctional, it ticks along quite nicely. But then she kind of comes in and just brings this completely different energy, which probably someone like Fred and Dee haven't been around in years. She's always used in the exact right place. Bruce is so clever, because just as it's starting to get a little bit too heavy and a little bit too kind of icky, Effie just walks in and diffuses the whole situation, because she's so blissfully unaware. She's so oblivious. She's just in her own world. And that selfishness and that self-absorbed way that she behaves is actually probably quite refreshing to some of them, because there's a lack of judgment there from her. Which I don't think is out of kindness, but it's out of she doesn't care enough. All the visitors that come into the house, apart from Effie, have got a definite stance and a definite judgment on these men, whereas I think she's the only one who comes in without that. She's completely judgment-free zone. That's what she is to me anyway, and that's what's so liberating to play, is that I've been told my whole life how I should feel about men like this, and, you know, and this person just, and I've always thought myself, but do I feel like that? I don't know if I think that they're fundamentally evil, to quote the play. So to play someone like Effie, who seems to just not really have any of those judgments or preconceived ideas, is really nice.
There was a line in the play that really stuck with me, and I think it was that, I'm not sure if I have the exact number, but something around 76% of pedophiles were abused themselves. And I looked it up afterwards, and I was so interested in that, and I saw that the research is actually really controversial about how it's not exactly clear how many people were abused themselves. But I think regardless of what the actual figure is, for me, what was interesting is I think we're often always looking for tidy explanations for why someone is a sex offender or a pedophile or would abuse children in this way. Glenn, I wonder your thoughts on that.
Now, having done some of the research for the play and done the play, I think that obviously there's one stance where you could say, well, these people are fundamentally evil and they're the scum of the earth, or these people have problems or they're sick. As Fred says in the play, they have a sickness. I think that when you come see the play, like you just said, your things like that, they strike you like, okay, where does this come from? If 76%, whether that's true or not, let's say it's 50% of the people who are abusers have been abused. You know, I know the famous quote, hurt people hurt people. You know, wherever it comes from, it started somewhere. And do we have the necessary things in place to sort of figure out how do we stop it in the beginning? And when it has started, what do we do as a society to, if not cure these people, get them all the help that they need so that they can become productive citizens in the world?
This is such an intense production that you all are a part of. It was very intense just for me to watch sitting in the audience. Honestly, I just sat during the intermission and I just wanted to sit there because I just felt like I needed to absorb what I had just seen. Was it hard for you all to detach from the roles that you're playing on stage every night?
At first, in rehearsals, we were consumed by it. We every night would go to Front Bar, which is the theatre bar, and just talk about it and dissect it. And I felt like all I was talking about was the play and the content of the play. And then I think it gets to a point where you have to just gently detach slightly because go home and watch something like The Office just to kind of... And we are really silly backstage. We say that, you know, the most serious, heavy plays probably encourage the most lighthearted behaviour backstage because you have to have some kind of release, and you're hearing through the speaker every night and every day this incredible but really, really heavy play. And I think you just have to, at some point, just detach from it. And also, like, personally, my character is so... like I was saying before, so oblivious to everything that's going on that I just got to a point where I was like, I just have to be like her. I just have to come in with the energy of, I don't know what's going on, blah, blah, blah. I'm just here to have pizza. And once I did that and once I made that shift, it was a lot easier. But it's hard when you have maybe friends or family coming to watch the play. And of course, this is the first time that they've ever heard it or seen it. So they then want to discuss it for hours and hours afterwards. And it starts to be like, you know, and that's great, and that's exactly what we want. We want that discussion, but it can get to the point where it's quite nice when you can just go home and just detach from it.
So I mentioned that this is a co-production with the National Theatre of Great Britain. And so it's a co-commission, co-production, British and American cast. And I wonder if you all think that, I'm curious if you think that British audiences will receive this play any differently, or if there are any other cultural differences with having a British and American cast as you all have approached this?
I think the audience in Britain is very different. They're not as vocal. That's kind of the norm, is that everyone's a bit quieter. I found it quite fun and shocking here the first night, even on the first preview, that people get so involved. England tends to be a bit more suppressed and they just kind of keep it a bit more low key. But I do think that they're going to love it. It's just not going to be maybe as immediately obvious that they're with you, because that's just the culture. But I do have a feeling that, especially the National, how it is now, like since Rufus Norris has been the artistic director, he's definitely changed the audience. He's bringing in a lot more diversity, and the theatre's getting a lot more challenging and interesting since he's been there. So I think that it's the perfect place to be, and it's good. It's the perfect time as well. So I think people are going to love it.
Well, that's Downstate, as we've been talking about, this very thought-provoking piece of work that's on right now at Steppenwolf in Chicago. It is on through November 18th. And then, as we've been talking about, next year will be staged in London. I want to thank Glenn Davis and Amy Lou Wood, two actors a part of this play by Bruce Norris. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. Our Twitter handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On Facebook, if you search for the 21st to like us, it's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just head to our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vashish Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.